am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading today from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essays on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his leadership before and during World War II. We pick up the story in 1939 with Hitler's march through Western Europe. Violating a promise he made at Munich, Adolf Hitler seized the rest of Czechoslovakia in March 1939. Roosevelt asked the House and Senate to repeal existing neutrality constraints in order to aid England and France in event of war, but the Senate refused to weigh the matter until the following year. "Well, Captain, we may as well face the facts," his grizzled Vice President John Nance Garner of Texas advised Roosevelt. "You haven't got the votes, and that's all there is to it." That July, Roosevelt asked his Attorney General Frank Murphy how far he could go in ignoring the Neutrality Act, even though he did sign it. In August 1939, Nazi Germany forged a non-aggression pact with Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union. At that moment, the Fuhrer was demanding the semi-autonomous German free city of Danzig, which enjoyed a customs union with Poland and a transportation route across the Polish access corridor along the Vistula River, all guaranteed by the Treaty of Versailles. On Friday, September 1st, after Hitler's demand was rejected, a blitzkrieg of German divisions pierced the Polish frontier, which Britain was pledged to defend. At the White House, President Roosevelt was awakened at 2:50 in the morning for a telephone report from his ambassador in Paris, William Bullitt. "Well, Bill, it's come at last," replied the president. "God help us all." The usually buoyant Roosevelt was visibly shaken by the coming of war. Meeting with his cabinet that Friday afternoon, Roosevelt confided aloud that Ambassador Bullitt's call had made him feel suddenly propelled through time back to the Great War of 1914, stating, "I was almost startled by a strange feeling of familiarity, a feeling that I had been through it all before. During the long years of the World War, the telephone at my bedside with a direct wire to the Navy Department had time and again brought me other tragic messages in the night. The same messages were sent around, the same lights snapped on the nerve centers of government. I had, in fact, been through it all before. It was not strange to me, but more like picking up again an interrupted routine. Unless some miracle beyond our present grasp changes the hearts of men, the days ahead will be crowded days, crowded with the same problems, the same anxieties that filled to the brim those September days of 1914. For history does, in fact, repeat itself." Lest some department secretary leaked that the chief was now scheming to take the nation into Europe's new conflict, Roosevelt quickly added, stating, "The parallel of then and now is striking, but it must go no further. True patriotism in this hour of crisis includes the determination that no warlike events shall be permitted to disturb the peaceful and orderly pursuits of the American people." 2 days later on Sunday, Great Britain and France declared war against Germany. Roosevelt received a call from his despairing ambassador in London, Joseph Kennedy, a Chamberlain friend and disciple, who told the president, "It's the end of the world, the end of everything." That night in a fireside chat, Roosevelt, no doubt recalling Wilson's demand of 1914 that Americans be impartial in thought as well as action, told his radio listeners, "This nation will remain a neutral nation, but I cannot ask that every American remain neutral in thought as well." Still, Roosevelt soon asked the leaders of Congress to call their members back from summer recess to repeal the Neutrality Acts. Travick, outraged by the growing possibility of American involvement in Europe, Charles Lindbergh, an American hero since making the first transatlantic solo aerial crossing, gave his first formal speech since the kidnapping and murder of his infant son in 1932. By radio, Lindbergh warned that the new conflict was not a question of banding together to defend the white race from invasion, but simply one of those age-old struggles within our own family of nations, a quarrel arising from the errors of the last war. Lindbergh predicted that if the United States got in, we are likely to lose 1 million men, possibly several million, the best of American youth. Roosevelt argued before a special joint session of Congress that revising the neutrality statutes would help the United States to remain a peaceful citadel in the Western world in which civilization may be kept alive. Roosevelt pledged to be guided by one single hard-headed thought, keeping America out of war. After the president spoke, Gallup found that 60% of Americans wanted the neutrality acts repealed. In this, Roosevelt was aided by the hasty collapse of Poland, which was then divided between the Soviet Union and Germany. But he privately felt he was almost literally walking on eggs. He persuaded Congress to cancel the arms embargo. Still, U.S. bank loans to belligerents were barred in favor of cash and carry. The House and Senate also forbade deliveries by U.S. vessels on the Atlantic Ocean, whose sinking might thrust the country into Europe's war. Before Christmas 1939, back on home leave, Ambassador Joseph Kennedy asked the president whether he planned to run for a third term. "Joe, I can't," Roosevelt replied. "I can't take it. What I need is a year's rest. You do too. You may think you're resting at times, but the subconscious idea of war and its problems, bombings and all that, is going on in your brain all the time. I just won't go for a third term unless we are in war." Knowing that Kennedy, who fiercely opposed Americans' involvement in the war, was listening for signs that his chief might be secretly plotting to take the nation into battle, the president caught himself. "Even then, I'll never send an army over. We'll help them, but with supplies only." In the spring of 1940, Hitler's army seized Norway and Denmark. By June, the Germans had conquered France, and Italy had declared war against the British and French. Before speaking at the University of Virginia's commencement, Roosevelt learned that the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini had deployed his forces against France. Outraged, Roosevelt told the audience that the hand that held the dagger has struck it into the back of its neighbor, warning that the United States could not survive as a lone island in a world dominated by the philosophy of force. Roosevelt vowed to extend to the opponents of force the material resources of this nation. The new British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, who had replaced the discredited Chamberlain, wrote Roosevelt that he felt fortified by the grand scope of your declaration. Now that the president faced a thicket of political challenges, he wished to persuade Congress and the American people to back his efforts to strengthen American defense and aid England, as well as the forcible draft of young men for the armed forces, unprecedented in peacetime, which would incite many people to say that he was pushing the nation into the war. Unless he helped the British people to stave off Germany, they might conclude their resistance was futile and demand Churchill's replacement by another leader who would make the best possible deal with Hitler. At the end of June, Roosevelt was startled when the Republicans at Philadelphia nominated a dark horse, Wendell Willkie. A New York utilities executive and registered Democrat until 1939, Willkie had been promoted by Northeastern internationalists who wished to aid England. Eleanor Roosevelt wrote her friend Lorena Hickok that she had a hunch that Willkie would defeat her husband. Responding to the challenge, the president broadened his cabinet in early July by appointing two Republicans, Frank Knox as Secretary of the Navy and Henry Stimson as Secretary of War. To prevent the emergence of a serious opponent for his party's nomination, Roosevelt had encouraged almost every major Democrat to run and hence split the field. It did not require much vanity for him to conclude that no one else could match his leadership skills in handling the European crisis. In July, when his convention met in Chicago, he was privately willing to become the nation's first third-term president. Roosevelt knew that the best way to do this was to feign unwillingness or indifference about staying in office and be drafted by the delegates. The convention chairman, Senator Alvin Barkley of Kentucky, conveyed a message from Roosevelt at the White House that he lacked any desire or purpose to continue in the office of president and that delegates were free to vote for any candidate. This provoked a well-orchestrated demonstration with organ music and a marching band in which Chicago's superintendent of sewers, Thomas Gary, from beneath the hall, roared over loudspeakers, "Everybody wants Roosevelt," and "The world needs Roosevelt." The president was anointed on the first ballot. Roosevelt enjoyed such mastery of the convention that when delegates rebelled against his choice for vice president, Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace, a Republican until 1936, he prevailed by threatening to decline the presidential nomination. Ensuring his command of foreign policy, he penciled in a crucial change to the Democratic platform, which pledged that the country will not participate in foreign wars, adding, "except in case of attack." 2 weeks after his renomination, Roosevelt called for a peacetime military draft. The isolationist, Senator Burton Wheeler, Democrat from Montana, warned that if Congress passed such a bill, it would slit the throat of the last great democracy still living and accord to Hitler his greatest and cheapest victory. But the Army Chief of Staff, General George Marshall, insisted that there was no conceivable way to ensure national defense without conscription of soldiers. Stimson agreed. Against the backdrop of the French defeat and Britain's valiant efforts to survive, one poll found that public support for a draft had risen from almost half the country in June to 86% by the end of August. Wilkie helped the cause by proclaiming that conscription was the only democratic way in which to assure the trained and competent manpower we need. Congress easily passed Roosevelt's Selective Service Act in September. That same month, the president announced that he planned to trade 50 American destroyers left over from the World War I in exchange for 99-year leases to British naval installations in the Atlantic and Caribbean. Winston Churchill had privately asked Roosevelt in June for the vessels as a matter of life and death, warning, "We will carry out the struggle, whatever the odds, but it may be beyond our resources unless we receive reinforcement." Roosevelt took the precaution of securing from his Attorney General Robert Jackson a written opinion affirming his authority to trade the ships by executive agreement. Senator Nye warned that a destroyer trade would thrust the nation into a war of European power politics and seriously weaken our own defenses. Roosevelt told Congress that his transaction would be the most important action in the reinforcement of our national defense since the Louisiana Purchase, stating, "Then as now, considerations of safety from overseas attack were fundamental." Flailing, Wendell Wilkie blustered that the deal was the most arbitrary and dictatorial action any American president had ever taken. But the Gallup poll found that the destroyer deal helped Roosevelt improve his position against Wilkie during the election from a near tie in late August to a 10-point lead by mid-September. Unhappy about his loss of political strength, Wilkie needed an issue. In mid-September, Gallup poll reported that 52% of Americans said the nation's most important goal should be to help England win, even at the risk of getting into the war. But 48% said it should be to keep out of war ourselves. By October, the Germans were subjecting London to the Blitz, but it no longer seemed likely that Hitler would soon conquer England. The lessening of the crisis caused many voters to conclude that Roosevelt's reelection was now less essential. Desperate to catch up with the president, Wendell Wilkie transformed his campaign image into that of the man who would keep Americans out of war. He knew this would require him to hide his actual intentions and to scare the public with lurid half-truths about what Roosevelt would do. But if that was the price of winning the presidency, Wilkie was willing to pay it. "Who really thinks that the president is sincerely trying to keep us out of the war?" Wilkie demanded of crowds. Charging that Roosevelt had made secret plans to enter Europe's conflict if reelected, Wilkie insisted that the president unveil any international understandings to put America into the war that we citizens do not know about. In Boston, where so many voters of Irish and Italian descent opposed engagement in Europe, Wilkie promised that if he became president, our boys shall stay out of European wars. In Baltimore, Wilkie warned that on the basis of Roosevelt's past performances with pledges, if the president won a third term, you may expect war by April 1941. Other Republicans warned of a secret Roosevelt pact with England that would drag American sons into battle. The president told his Interior Secretary Harold Ickes that Wilkie's allegations had made him fighting mad. He knew that a major reason why Americans suspected that he would take them into war in Europe if reelected was that Woodrow Wilson had done exactly that after campaigning on the tricky implicit promise of his 1916 slogan, "He kept us out of war." At first, Roosevelt carefully resisted the temptation to pledge more than he knew he could deliver. 2 weeks before the election, joining the campaign trail in Philadelphia, Roosevelt offered Americans his most solemn assurance that there is no secret treaty, no secret obligation with any other government to involve this nation in any war. But on Halloween Eve, with Wilkie said to be within striking distance of victory, the president went one step further. At the Boston Garden, he told the throng, "I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." While riding by train to Boston, Sam Rosenman, Roosevelt's speechwriter, had asked his chief why he did not plan to add his standard phrase, "except in a case of attack." "It's not necessary," replied the president. "If we're attacked, it's no longer a foreign war." Listening to Roosevelt's speech on the radio, Wilkie exclaimed, "That hypocritical son of a bitch. This is going to beat me." Roosevelt's artful language provoked later charges that he had tricked Americans into battle. Later in 1944, the Republican Congresswoman Clare Booth Luce of Connecticut charged at her party's convention that the president had lied us into war because he did not have the political courage to lead us into it. Roosevelt defeated Wilkie by 54.7 to 44.8% of the popular vote, and with 449 electoral votes to Wilkie's 82. Emerging from the big house in Hyde Park, New York, under the glare of artificial lights, Roosevelt told his supporters, "I don't need to tell you that we face difficult days in this country." That same week, the Boston Globe newspaper published quotations from an interview with Joseph Kennedy on Home Lead from England, who had told a reporter that democracy is all finished in England and there is no sense into getting into the war. We'd just be holding the bag. More damaging, the envoy had predicted that democracy might also be done in the United States because of the loss of trade with Europe might change our form of government. If America joined the war, a bureaucracy would take over right off. Everything we hold dear would be gone. "They told me that after 1918 we got it all back, but this is different," said Kennedy. Roosevelt was in no position to let Kennedy's insistence that beleaguered Britain was a lost cause, or that the U.S. government was headed for an autocracy. After calling him to Hyde Park for a dressing down, he told Eleanor Roosevelt in fury, "I never want to see that son of a bitch again as long as I live." By December 1940, it was clear that both the Blitz and Hitler's invasion blueprint for England, Operation Sea Lion, were failures. But the British had lost more than 500 merchant ships and were almost bankrupt. Churchill wrote Roosevelt that soon we shall no longer be able to pay cash for shipping and other supplies. Roosevelt devised a way to satisfy Churchill's wish list by letting the British compensate the United States or return the borrowed goods when that was possible, which he called lend-lease. With his talent for homespun imagery, Roosevelt told reporters that if his neighbor's house caught fire, he would not say, "My garden hose cost me $15, you have to pay me $15 for it." Instead, he would simply want my garden hose back after the fire is over. In a fireside chat 2 nights before the end of 1940, Roosevelt used alarmist language he would never have dared employed during the campaign. Never before since Jamestown and Plymouth Rock has our American civilization been in such danger as now. The Nazi masters of Germany have made it clear that they intend not only to dominate all life and thought in their own country, but also to enslave the whole of Europe, and then to use the resources of Europe to dominate the rest of the world, stated Roosevelt. He cautioned against American appeasers, seeking a bargain with Hitler to keep out of the war. Nonsense. It is a negotiated peace if a gang of outlaws surrounds your community and on threat of extermination makes you pay tribute to save your own skins. Instead, referring to Lend-Lease and his defense production program, Roosevelt demanded, "We must be the great arsenal of democracy." On Monday, January 6, 1941, Roosevelt delivered his annual message to Congress, which is now properly called the State of the Union Address. Offering a history lesson, he recalled that before the Great War of 1914, Americans had never suffered a serious external threat to our national safety or our continued independence. The War of 1812 had been waged to vindicate our right to peaceful trade. Even in 1914, the European conflict seemed to raise only a small threat of danger to our own American future. But then Americans realized that what the downfall of democratic nations might mean to our own democracies. More daring now, Roosevelt insisted, we need not overemphasize imperfection in the Peace of Versailles. When the current war ended, he proposed, the United States should seek a world founded upon four freedoms, of speech and expression, permitting every person to worship God in his own way, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. That same week, Roosevelt submitted his Lend-Lease bill, gradually called H.R. 1776. Gallup poll found that Americans supported it by 54% to 22%. Nevertheless, Senator Wheeler warned that the plan would plow under every fourth American boy. Arthur Vandenberg, the Republican senator from Michigan, carped that it would let the president make war on any country he chooses, anytime he pleases. On the same day in February that Lend-Lease passed the House by a vote of 260 to 165, Wendell Willkie testified for the measure before the Senate. The merchants of death, theorist Gerald Nye reminded him of his campaign prediction that Roosevelt would have the country at war by April 1941. Do you still agree that that might be the case? It might be, replied Willkie. It was a bit of campaign oratory. The Senate passed Lend-Lease in March by a vote of 60 to 31, after which Congress voted $7 billion in immediate war aid to England, a figure larger than most of the entire federal budgets of the 1930s. Under the fragment of the Neutrality Act still in force, Great Britain would have to transport the shipments from America, and Hitler's U-boats were destroying British ships on the Atlantic. By executive order, Roosevelt expanded the area to be patrolled by U.S. ships all the way to a longitude line 25 degrees west that ran between Africa and Latin America. He announced that the American patrols would alert the British if they spied hostile ships, but the United States would not supply the British vessels with convoys, which were foreclosed by the Lend-Lease Act. After conferring with the exiled leaders of Denmark, which had been overwhelmed by Germany, the president also sent American troops to occupy Greenland. Roosevelt's decision to extend the U.S. security zone so far across the Atlantic dramatically increased the chance that German submarines would attack American ships. As the old Navy man knew from the Spanish-American conflict and the Great War of 1914, a submarine attack on a U.S. vessel could provoke previously skeptical Americans to clamor for war. Those who now cite Pearl Harbor in support of the argument that the president was deliberately creating the conditions for an attack by a hostile nation that would galvanize Americans to enter the conflict against Hitler might be looking in the wrong place. In May, Roosevelt told his cabinet that he was not willing to fire the first shot. Secretary of War Stimson wrote in his diary that Roosevelt shows evidence of waiting for the accidental shot of some irresponsible captain on either side to be the occasion of his going to war. In June, when Germany invaded the Soviet Union, Roosevelt told reporters, "Of course, we are going to give all the aid that we possibly can to Russia." The following month, he ordered 4,400 Marines to replace British soldiers in Iceland. The Navy's Admiral Stark considered this directive practically an act of war. In August, Roosevelt met with Churchill aboard the HMS Prince of Wales and the USS Augusta off Newfoundland. The Prime Minister beseeched him to ask Congress to enter the war against Germany. He would rather have this with no supplies for 6 months than double the supplies and no declaration. Roosevelt declined, but he offered to provide British escorts with U.S. armed vessels as far east as Iceland. He also joined Churchill to issue a public document on Anglo-American goals and principles, which was called the Atlantic Charter. The Prime Minister privately found it astonishing that the United States, still technically neutral, would join with a belligerent power in making such a declaration. Returning to London, Churchill informed his war cabinet that Roosevelt had confided to him that he would become more and more provocative, and if the Germans did not like it, they could attack the American forces. In September, near Iceland, a German sub fired torpedoes at the USS destroyer Greer. Even though they missed, the president announced that there should be another such incident American commanders could shoot on sight. At that moment, Roosevelt was considering whether to confer with the Japanese Prime Minister, Prince Fumimaro Konoye, in Alaska, for an effort to make peace in the Pacific, while the president and the American people were primarily absorbed by the crisis in Europe. His nation had been edging towards confrontation with Japan. Reading from presidential historian Michael Beschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the run-up to World War II will be continued. This is Wallace Klingdienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.